Merritt Street, we're building a new morning show where our guiding principle is to always value your time.
We'd love for you to join us. Be part of our community.
Each morning will be packed full of news, information, advice, and a lot of fun.
And we promise we'll never waste your time.
I'm Dominique Soxa.
I'm Fanchon Singer. Join us for Morning on Merritt Street.
8 a.m. Eastern, 7 Central. Essential television.
Okay, welcome back to Fill in the Blanks. I appreciate you listening in, subscribing, and sharing the podcast. Now, today, I'm speaking with Mr. Victor Avila. He is a retired supervisory special agent with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, Homeland Security Investigation, HSI, under the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Now, listen in to this insightful conversation, and you will never look at Homeland Security the same way again, I promise you. Now, Victor has been on the show before when we were talking about the border and my trip down there, and I was so absolutely fascinated by what Victor had to say that I have been waiting selfishly to get him all by himself so we could sit down and talk about all his experience, wisdom, and insight about what's going on at the border. When he was on the show, we had other guests, and there were things to talk about and cover, and I wanted you all to myself so we could spend all of this time talking about it. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Phil. Great to be here.
Tell me how long you've been involved with the border and what all you've done there. Give everybody an idea of what your history is with our border.
I'm born and raised in El Paso, Texas, and so I've been on the border most of my life. I've been in law enforcement since the age of 22. I've worked at every level of government, county level, state level, federal level as a special agent, and international as a U.S. diplomat in Mexico and Europe. So I worked in many different capacities and investigated many different crimes. When it came to Homeland Security, I want people to understand that our jurisdiction is that of anything that touches our border. Anything that has a nexus or a violation to the nexus to our border, HSI, Homeland Security Investigations, has that jurisdiction to investigate it. So we're talking about the illegal movement of people and goods. A lot of times right now we're concentrating, obviously, on the people and illegal immigration, but let's not forget also the commercial side of it and the customs side of it, which we're trying to defend the homeland with illegal substances coming in. And I'm not just talking about drugs and fentanyl. I'm talking about pharmaceuticals. I'm talking about cotton T-shirts that are not 100% cotton that they say that they are, and many other things and goods that come through that border. There's a lot of enforcement happening every single day to protect our homeland.
You're a retired supervisory special agent with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Homeland Security Investigations. So what are you doing now?
Well, I medically retired in 2015 after going through a horrific event in my career when I was assigned in Mexico at the U.S. Embassy. My partner, Special Agent Jaime Zapata, and I were ambushed by a cartel on an assignment and were shot at over 100 rounds. Special Agent Jaime Zapata tragically lost his life in the line of duty. I'm here by the grace of God being able to tell you this story after taking 3 bullets. And so that happened in 2011. That led to my retirement in 2015 with a lot of details that I'm leaving out. But I never stopped fighting. Ever since I retired, I wrote a book, one that I think I got you a copy last time, Agent Under Fire.
Thank you.
Because I wanted to, first of all, let people who I am and the tragedy that happened in Mexico. But also at the end of that book, I wanted people to know what my expertise and what I know about the border. This is what I've done all my life. And I wrote about it. And I wrote that book almost 3 years ago. And you think I wrote it yesterday with the information that's on there, because it's covering the wall, sanctuary cities, immigration, asylum criteria, everything that we're seeing at the border today. My subject matter expertise is human trafficking investigations. and dealt a lot with those, that horrific crime and rescuing a lot of women and children from captivity. It's a modern day slavery in the U.S. And so I wrote about that, and I become a consultant, a public speaker, dabbled a little bit into politics, didn't work out for me, but I'm trying. I'm trying every which way to be able to be part of the solution.
And I want to leave you with this. I want to be part of the solution here. I'm not going away. I got other projects, but I want to be part of the solution. I want to be able to use my voice. I want to be able to use my platform, not as big as yours, Brandon. I don't have millions of followers, but I do have a voice out there. I do have an expertise. And I want to thank all of you that supported me in this race. But I always ultimately said, and I promised to Brandon that if he would make it to the runoff, I would support them. And I'm standing by my word. That's why I'm here today.
Unfortunately, a lot of stuff that we're going to talk about today has become very partisan. I personally believe that it shouldn't be. I think the protection of the American people, public safety, and national security shouldn't be politically partisan, but unfortunately it is. And so that's why I dabble into the politics of it, because you have to kind of understand that as well to approach it and bring in viable solutions.
Well, the book, Agent Under Fire, you say you could have written it now. You could have written it this weekend because things haven't changed for the better, that's for sure. And congratulations on that book. And so people understand, let's go back to that day in 2011 when you and your partner were ambushed. Let's talk about how that happened, where it happened, and you took over 100 rounds of fire. You were hit 3 times. Your partner, Agent Zapata, lost his life. Take me through that event. What happened that day? Where were you? What cartel was it? Tell people what happened.
We were at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City on Valentine's Day on February 14th when the assignment came down. The assignment was a botched assignment, and I say it very confidently. It was an assignment that was not normally given by my superiors or my supervisors. The adequate standard operating procedure that we dealt with in Mexico was not provided to us that time. And what I'm talking about is Mexican federal police or Mexican military escorting us, and additional U.S. law enforcement escorting us in these armored vehicles that we drove, because that's the way we drove. This Highway 57 is the main corridor from Mexico City up to Texas. And they wanted me and Agent Zapata to go pick up some equipment, some boxes of equipment. That's all I knew that it was back then. My understanding, it was some surveillance equipment for a other money laundering case that we were working on, and tracking devices and sort. Some was going to be for us, some was going to be for the Mexican government. But it was kind of go get it and bring it back. Well, I had a lot of questions about it. And I challenged the assignment because we knew that Highway 57, a major part of that. And when I say Highway 57, it's the interstate. It's the toll road, the safe road, was controlled by Los Zetas cartel. And we knew the intelligence that that there was a lot of firefights and confrontations between Los Zetas cartel and Mexican federal police and military. So much that the ambassador, about 3 weeks before this assignment came down, had issued an alert to all U.S. personnel prohibiting us from driving on that highway for personal or business reasons. And that was ignored. So despite my challenges, they were ignored. I'll quote the deputy attaché at that time. He said, after I made my supervisor go and tell him everything that I just told you, he came out of his office and said that he wasn't aware of any security reasons in Mexico. And I kind of told him the whole country of Mexico is a security concern. And so there we were, ordered. And so the following day, Agent Zapata and I go in my armored vehicle and head off. We make arrangements with the ICE agents from the Monterey office to kind of meet halfway. We end up driving a little bit more than they did. We meet up at kilometer marker 100, exchange those boxes. It was a lot of boxes, so much that it took out not only just folding the third row seats, but also the second row seats to fill the entire cabin or back area of the SUV. exchange it, and driving back, I was still driving, stopped at the Subway sandwich there because Agent Zapata wanted to eat Subway. And after lunch, I gave him the keys for his turn to drive. I was working on a BlackBerry, working a lot of, I was looking for a fugitive. I was putting together a human trafficking conference. And so that was going to allot me some time to work. But within 15 to 20 minutes of Agent Zapata taking the wheel, we got initially passed by two SUVs at a high rate of speed. And Agent Zapata is the one that gave me the heads up and said, hey, heads up. I look up and I see the silhouette of a rifle sticking in between the seats of the second SUV. And I told Agent Zapata, just let them go. We didn't know who they were. And they sped off. Well, before you knew it, we were on them.
I don't know about you, but I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Every day is an opportunity to be your best self. But sometimes our bodies don't keep up with our ambitions. That's where Balance 7 comes in, giving you the edge you need to thrive. Balance 7 has been the secret weapon for anyone looking to boost their energy, improve recovery, enhance their overall well-being, and strengthen their immune system for better overall health. Now, crafted with care, their alkalizing formula is designed to help your body combat acidity, promoting better health and a stronger immune system by simply taking 1 ounce of Balance 7 three times a day. Most people feel the difference within 3 days, and that's why over 6 million bottles have been sold worldwide. Take the first step towards feeling your best every day. Visit balance7.com/Phil. That's balance7.com/Phil. Balance 7, where health meets harmony.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
They had slowed down to about 20 miles an hour, and we came up on them, and they immediately started conducting what we call a rolling roadblock. The first SUV in front of you brakes substantially. At the same time, the SUV next to us pushes to the right. We trained this at the academy, and Agent Zapata initially tried to maneuver his way out of that, and they pushed us back in. The second time they recouped, the SUV next to Jaime on the driver's side door took out AK-47s, and they were screaming and yelling all in Spanish to stop and to pull over. Eventually, they forced us off to the right shoulder of the highway, coming to a complete stop. About 8 Los Zetas cartel members. Now, keep in mind, we had no idea these were cartel members. We had no idea who they were. And they were not dressed in military attire. They were not dressed in all black or tactical gear. They were in jeans, t-shirts, very clean cut, very short, very fit type looking soldier. Reminded me of a very southern Mexico or even Central American looking. And they half surrounded our Suburban. The Suburban was unlocked at the time that Agent Zapata placed it in park. The Suburban was programmed to unlock the 4 doors. And we just didn't realize it at that time. One of the shooters comes to Jaime's side driver door, opens the door, which surprised him, surprised Agent Zapata, and surprised me on the passenger seat. But immediately Agent Zapata grabs the handle and shuts the door, and we start hitting that lock button. And that upset he had a handgun, the guy that opened the door, eventually shooting some rounds towards the door and the front tire. And that's the first time it took me a second to really realize, I remember saying this in my brain, did he just shoot at the door? It was very, very surreal to me. And before you know it, two of the shooters came to my window. My window was rolled down 2 inches. When we hit those buttons, we inadvertently hit the window button, and they rolled it down. One came in with an AK-47, another with a handgun by my head, and I immediately kind of braced. Remember, we're full of boxes here. Mm-hmm. I raise the window. It catches a barrel of both guns. I see the shooter trying to wiggle the rifle, and without notice, they open fire into the cabin, striking Agent Zapata multiple times. And then one, the fatal one in his leg. At one point, I grabbed a handgun. I don't know what I was trying to do, hold it, pull it, you know, keep it from shooting. Had burned all the skin off of my index finger because it was very hot. And then they pulled the guns out. I raised the window and they just started spraying it with bullets on that side. I tell Agent Zapata, go, go. He yells out, I'm hit. I put the Suburban in drive. He puts his foot on the gas. I push his leg down there. We crash the vehicle in front of us, trying to get back on the highway. Agent Zapata became unresponsive, and the Suburban really rolled from the right shoulder, passing into the highway into the median. And that's where it ended up. It was disabled at that point. Flat tires, and they shot over many, many rounds. So one SUV leaves. Then I see the second SUV leave, but it makes a U-turn, comes back, parks right in front of us, and they stare at me, and they stand right in front of the hood with AK-47s, and they open fire, trying to penetrate the glass. And I provide you with some pictures where, you know, at that point, I just froze in the front seat. And then they stop firing. They get back in their SUV and take off. I made a frantic phone call. I didn't provide that call, but it's online. I could provide it for you. It's a frantic phone call that I made. I, for some reason, called the U.S. Embassy switchboard. Mm-hmm. And I basically said, this is Victor Avila with ICE. We've been shot on the highway. Please send help. I didn't know exactly our location. Where we were. A lot of phone calls started happening. It went to from there to the regional security office where my wife was working. She was basically 5 feet away when the receptionist got the call. She didn't know what to do. She went down the hallway and said, Agent Avila's on the phone, has been shot. Well, my wife comes out of her office and says, what did you just say? Well, there's an Agent Avila on the phone that's been shot. So my wife goes into distress. Diplomatic security special agents get on the phone. ICE agents get on the phone. A lot of people on the phone. I eventually called. The only person I could trust in Mexico at that point was the commander of our vetted unit, the head of our unit. He was the one that was able to deploy a helicopter, kept us there for over, took 40 minutes. It's a long, long time.
Yeah, it's a long time. When were you shot? We saw the picture of the front window.
Yeah.
Had you been shot at
before,
that point?
I had been shot before. That window held. I got shot once in the chest and twice in my left leg. The bottom of my leg, I didn't even know until they put me in the helicopter and they told me I'd been shot in the bottom of my left leg. But I could see the one here. Initially, when I got on the phone with the ICE agent, who's a friend of mine and ex-paramedic, he's the one that first told me to check myself physically because there was a lot of shrapnel and glass, and I had a lot of cuts and blood on my face. And I also had a lot of Hymas blood because I was trying to, you know, attend to his wound. What those do is these armored vehicles, these windows, if you continue to shoot on that glass in the same spot, it'll eventually give way. And I think that's what they're trying to do. Inside, it bubbles in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just so thankful that it held. But it's not until my friend actually told me to physically check myself that I saw the open wound in my chest and saw the blood coming down in my jeans. And then I saw my left leg, and you know, I took my belt and used it as a tourniquet. There are many, many. So they shot, I don't know how many, over 100 here. And then, of course, I don't know how many in front of us when they did that U-turn.
Is everything here bulletproof, the metal and the windows?
Yes.
The whole car's bulletproof.
Yes, but to understand metal, I tell people all the time, it's like a waterproof shoes. Doesn't mean they're not going to get wet.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of.
It slows it and changes its trajectory.
It's a lot of rounds that actually made it into the SUV through crevices, the undercarriage and such.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't protect you 100%. Obviously, it protected me enough for me to be here to tell you the story.
And then they airlifted you out of there.
The Mexican Federal Police sent their helicopter. The nearest town was San Luis Potosí, the town by the city by the same name of the state. We had very good care, but I was very, very petrified, very scared, because the cartels kill people at hospitals. I worked these cases when I was in Mexico.
Right.
I worked in Ciudad Juarez many times. They would
they
go
kill
to,
you when you get to the hospital.
Yeah, when they make sure that they made it alive. And so I was very, very scared. They eventually sent special forces from the federal police to surround and that medical building, the whole hospital was under the control of the police at that point. And it took a long time. The shooting happened at 2:15 p.m. The first Americans arrived sometime after 7 p.m. Had really good care, medical care in Mexico. A lot of other things happened, but eventually they flew me out in the middle of the night. DEA let us borrow their plane, and they flew me to Houston.
So you were unprotected at the hospital for 5 hours?
For about an hour. The support came in about an hour after I arrived, and the hospital staff didn't know that we were Americans. Obviously, the way they look, and I didn't want them to know that we were Americans. I didn't tell them my name. I refused any IV or any medication. They were doing sonograms. They were, they're cutting my shirt. They were doing all this treatment, but they didn't know who I was, and I wasn't about to tell them. I didn't tell them until those reinforcements. You see, in the police in Mexico, you don't call 911 and have the police show up. You have to call certain people you trust, because the corruption runs rampant over there. So not until the trusted officials showed up that I was able to tell them who we were.
Did they ever find the people that did the shooting? What happened to those?
Sure did. The U.S. government did a fantastic job. HSI, FBI, and other law enforcement agencies did a great job in tracking these guys down. They were arrested. Out of the 8 shooters, they arrested 7. One was presumed dead. Then were extradited to the U.S. They were all facing the death penalty, but because of the treaty we have with Mexico, they take the death penalty off the table, and they were all looking at a minimum mandatory life in prison. So then we get into the criminal justice system, which I think we kind of are experiencing now. Well, we experienced it a long time ago, because in 2017, we went to trial thinking that all of the defendants were going to go to trial. And my wife and I were surprised because 5 of them took a plea deal. And I said, okay, you see, I used to be a federal probation officer before I was an agent, so I understand the U.S. courts very well and the federal sentencing guidelines. And I couldn't understand if they're going to plead guilty. That was okay. I was okay with that, but it still called for the same sentence. Well, the federal government gave them what they call a 5K departure, meaning they departed from the minimum mandatory life sentence and sentenced them from 35 years down to 12 years for their cooperation. And I had never in my career ever seen that happen, from a life sentence to such a minimal time for killing a U.S. federal agent, but that's what it was. And so they pled guilty to attempted murder of an internationally protected person, and weapons charges. So the 2 that didn't went to trial. We went to trial. They were found guilty, and they were sentenced to life imprisonment. 2 years after that, everybody's okay. They're in prison. They're serving the sentences. Well, the 2 that received the life sentences appealed their sentence. In 2019, they said that the murder statute used against them to convict them of the murder of Agent Zapata was invalid because a murder happened extraterritorially, meaning because it happened outside of the U.S., and the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with them and dismissed the murder charge.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to LipsynAds.com now. That's LibsynAds.com.
The first page of a book never tells the full story. And those news alerts and headlines, like the ones we get on our phones, don't even scratch the surface of what the story is really all about. Stories are like people, multi-layered and complex. It takes some digging to find the truth, but when we find it, it can change our world. We like to dig. The news on Merritt Street, Essential Television.
They vacated, dismissed it. And so I was here by my house. I was in the car when I got the call, and I started crying about it because I had to now notify the Zapata family. I was kind of the one that was kind of the intermediary, or, the connector there, and talking and sending messages back and forth, and let them know that there's no one in prison now for the murder of their son. They're still in custody from the other charges. So I reach out to our elected officials, congressmen, senators, and to fight this and to fight this law. And it took us 2 years, but in November of 2021, President Biden signed the Jaime Zapata and Victor Avila Federal Officer and Employee Protection Act, meaning this will not happen to anyone else. It was basically a one-pager. I give a lot of credit to the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association because they helped a lot with their presence on the Hill. And it wasn't retroactive to our case, but at least it protects those men and women who continue to serve abroad. And just last year, last May, almost a year ago, we went back to have those two guys resentenced, and we begged the judge to resentence them back to life, and he did. And so those two that went to trial are in prison for life. The other five, one of them already has been released and deported.
Mm-hmm.
It's been over 12 years.
Wow. At least some effort was made. Is that cartel still in operation?
A great question, because they were kind of disbanded and dismantled, but they factioned off to CDN, and their new name is Cartel del Noreste, or Cartel of the Northeast, mm-hmm. which prominently works the Laredo, the Mexican side of Laredo, Texas, which is Nuevo Laredo. That's their area. They have other pockets here and there, but that's the control they have under. They're very big into Loseta, CDN, are very, very violent. These are the ones that introduced the decapitations and brutal killings in Mexico, kind of to show force and to show the other cartels by these methods of intimidation, terrorist type of activities, if you will. And so they continue. They're still there. They're still active. Some still use the old name of Losetas, but the new one of CDN is full in effect, not just in Mexico, but here as well.
What's happening on the border right now with human trafficking?
Human trafficking has a special place in my heart, because I'm a subject matter expert in the investigations of human trafficking and victim identification. And I never in my life had thought I would see the ability to be able to not just smuggle a human being, but traffic a child or a human being so freely. Because that's exactly what's happened. Under this administration, we had 400,000 unaccompanied children, and 100,000 of them have been lost through the process, Health and Human Services, giving them up to sponsors. I personally have seen them on airplanes, have flown with a child accompanied by a man that's not their father. It's some stranger, possibly an NGO member. I question them. They have no idea who the child is. They're basically delivering this child to an address in Gainesville, Florida, or anywhere throughout the U.S. And the ability to not do anything about it and sit in that airplane with them, it's very frustrating, to say the least, because I arrested people that did this. It's illegal to do that. Plus, the exploitation of that child. We have no idea what's going to happen to them. Not only is it, there's a lot of sexual exploitation. That's the main one. But lately has become labor, a lot of forced labor. And there was a big case in Florida where 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds were working at the slaughterhouses and the chicken farms. And so human trafficking is probably at its worst, but at its best for the cartels, because they're making billions of dollars in that industry.
How are they making billions of dollars? We just saw some pictures here of children coming through. These children that are coming through the wire here, these look like 8, 10-year-old, 5-year-old, obviously young. How many do you estimate are coming through that are not with family? They're not coming in here and setting up and living as a traditional family. They're not coming through with their parents.
At least 400,000 of them.
400,000?
Yes. So what happens is this child is identified as an unaccompanied child.
Right.
And is now taken from Border Patrol custody to Health and Human Services. Health and Human Services then has their job is to initially house them, take care of them, and then reunite them with a family member. But here's the problem. Those are just the ones that they know of. There's so many of them that this administration doesn't want them held in cages. They don't want them held because it doesn't look good. So they get them, the pressure is to push them out, move them out quickly. So Joe Blow in Chicago and so-and-so in LA and so-and-so in Miami says, I'm the sponsor for that child. Okay. So Health and Human Services makes the arrangements and gets that child to that household, to that apartment. The problem, Dr. Phil, is that there's no vetting of that person.
Could be that's anybody. Receiving.
Could be anybody. And the reason why we know that it happens is because we have actually arrested people in California. It's a sex offender that asked for the child. And luckily we found that one. But this child, these children sometimes are reunited with the family. I don't want to get that wrong. Sometimes we do reunite them with their family members in the U.S. But we have, first of all, we have 100,000 of them that are lost. We have no idea. We don't have a record of where they went.
What do you mean lost? We had a record, but then we don't know what happened to them?
We had them. We came in. We don't know where we don't know where we put them. We have no idea where these children are.
That's a city full of children, 100,000. That's a city.
It's disgraceful. It's what it is. And what's more disgraceful is the conditions that these children are in. Now, if you just common sense would tell you that a child needs a schooling, medical care, shelter, you know, a lot of things that might not be provided to them.
Well, how long do they have them before they're lost?
Very quickly, maybe a few days, a week, sometimes a month, depending on how quickly they can move them out of their custody from Health and Human Services. ORR is the other office that you won't hear a lot of people talk about. Office of Refugee and Resettlement has a big role as well in moving people along, family units.
So these children we're looking at are coming through the wire. They're obviously unaccompanied. So they come through, they're unaccompanied, so they take them and put them where?
Initially, it's Border Patrol.
Right.
And then because they're a minor, then eventually they'll go to Health and Human Services, or ORR, Office of Refugee and Resettlement.
And where
Office.
Do they put them?
They have facilities all across the border, even inside in Houston, San Antonio.
Well, are these cages?
These are facilities. No, they're not. They're nicer facilities. A lot of them are pop-up, soft-sided facilities that you've seen.
Tents.
And they go in there, take care of them, feed them, you know, they get medical care. But they don't want them there that much because political reasons or whatever. And then they ship them out. So they have a list of where is this child. A lot of these kids sometimes come with the address written on their forearm, or a piece of paper that says, I'm going to Dallas, Texas, or a phone number written on there, or on the wristband that they're wearing. And that's the only indication that Health and Human Services has to go on.
So that may be a family, or it could be a cartel.
We don't know who wrote that number on there. We don't know. It could be the family. It could be, for nefarious reasons, that the cartel gave this five-year-old kid, I've seen him so many times, here's an address and phone number. And that's what they use. And so that's where we're going to send this child. We have no idea who lives there.
Well, how's the cartel making billions of dollars off of these children?
Several ways. One is through the smuggling, which is different than trafficking. I want people to understand these are two different violations of law.
Okay.
There's a smuggling fee as a one-time fee to enter the United States. The cartel doesn't care if you walk up to Border Patrol as a give-up and turn yourself in, or if you want to go undetected, as a gotaway in the back of a tractor trailer. You still have to pay them the fee. So they're making thousands of dollars now. It's different prices for different nationalities. Chinese nationals, Eastern Europeans, Africans are the ones paying the most right now. I did a big Chinese smuggling case from China through Mexico to New York. This was years ago. And the Chinese nationals back then were paying $40,000 or $50,000 per head, individual.
Where are they getting that money?
They get the money.
Where?
The illegal gets the money, usually from family members. Usually it's borrowed. Usually they sell a property, but they get the money.
So it's their money.
Well, not necessarily there now.
Well, they're not getting it from the cartel.
Some tent is owed. No, not from the cartel. What's happening now, Dr. Phil, is that the cartel, because there's been millions of people coming through, some don't have the money to pay. So the cartel says, that's okay. That's fine. You owe me that money. And I'll give you a perfect example. I talked to, and I think I might have given you this example before, this young Nicaraguan kid owes them the $8,500 fee. And when he's in Minneapolis, which he is right now already, in Minnesota, is paying them $1,000 a month with a $300 penalty if he doesn't pay it on time. And now the cartel owns them as a indentured servitude type situation. They will use that child to do what? What is that child going to do, or that young man, to pay back this debt? Well, you have to sell fentanyl, enroll in the local community college and sell meth, help us smuggle others. Down at the border right now, you have illegal smuggling illegals. You have U.S. citizens, you have grandmas, you have gangs, you have everybody coming to the border, picking up and transporting. That's the smuggling part. That's a lot of the chunk of money they're making. The trafficking is the exploitation of these victims, usually for the sex slave trade, and they're reused over and over and over. So in the drug trade, you sell a kilo of cocaine, you make this incredible profit, and once it's sold, you got to go get back and you got to go get another kilo of cocaine. Well, the victim keeps on giving. And when you have 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 victims seeing an average of 20 to 30 johns a day at let's go conservative here, at $50 each, you start doing the math and that starts adding up very quickly. And that's just one victim. And so these organizations have learned, by the way, the cartels and the human traffickers and human smugglers were separate. They were different entities. Not anymore. The cartels have moved in and control all of it now. So when we, even when I investigated, there was a human smuggler, there was a human trafficker. They really didn't dabble with the cartels. Well, now it's the cartel owns all that because they realize the amount of money that these humans are paying. And this is a video that I shot in El Paso. Just a reminder of the amounts of people here, a lot of single adult males. So we talk about the children and we talk about the family units, but the majority, the highest percentage, and I forget the percentage, forgive me, but it's something like 70% of the people that are coming are single adult males. And you can see it by these videos that I myself shot. The majority of the people are coming are single adult males. That require a lot of, there's a lot of reasons here. You got health reasons. You have crime reasons. You have shelter. You have all these problems. When I was there, there's an outbreak of tuberculosis. There was an outbreak of measles. There was an outbreak of lice. And all of these health issues are showing up in small communities in Kentucky, North Carolina, and all these all around the nation. And, well, your child goes to that school, and all of a sudden they'll put a person next to your child. And for some reason now in a lot of communities there, they will, for some reason, prioritize the undocumented person over the U.S. citizen. We've seen this happen in New York. It's happened in El Paso. They will kick out the Americans to make room for them. But I'm not against immigration. I'm against illegal immigration. And this is the part where we need to establish some law and order here. The individuals now, and I'm going to use Venezuela as a perfect example. Venezuela, I saw the other day.
Where is this we're looking at?
El Paso, Texas. Downtown. Mostly Venezuelans, Central Americans, Colombians, South Americans.
You're saying a lot of these paid a fee.
Oh, they all did.
To be smuggled.
They all did. 100%.
And it doesn't matter whether they turned themselves into a border agent or they were a gotaway. They paid the money to get to the border.
They gave the money to come in.
And how much are they paying to get to the border?
Right now, the Mexican, other than, or we're calling OTM, Central American, about $8,500. Mm-hmm. Then you talk about Chinese nationals, you're in the tens of thousands, Africans, tens of thousands, Eastern Europeans, tens of thousands. The SIAs, special interest aliens coming from special interest countries, which is something that I investigated right before I got shot. I was doing a big Afghan smuggling, taking down an Afghan smuggling organization using Mexico. You see, you and I know this, and so do the cartels, and so do the criminal organizations, and so do the terrorists. They know that being in Mexico is as good as being in the U.S.
Yeah.
And so they just need to get to Mexico.
You just have to walk across the rivers, turn yourself in.
That's it. And so we don't know the criminal history of this person. We don't know the intention or the agenda that they have, because the there's a questionnaire out there, Dr. Phil, of a border agent. There's hundreds of questions that could and should be asked that are not being asked. And a lot of questions are very, very straightforward. You know, are you a member of any kind of, you know, political group? Are you a member of, literally a member of a terrorist organization? All these types of questions that are not being asked.
Well, of course, they're not going to tell the truth.
They're not, because they're being processed so quickly. Even when, because I talk to border agents all the time, even when the agent suspects, they have this individual in front of them. And I'll give an example in El Paso. There's this guy all tatted up. His eyes were tattooed. His pupils were black. And the border agent was telling me, like, I don't want to admit this guy, even though he put his fingerprints down and he was negative. He was clear of any criminal history in our databases, but he just didn't look right.
Yeah.
But
he didn't know you could tattoo
He says he looks scary. I need to make some phone calls to these consulates. I need to make, you know, other database. Well, that takes a lot of time. I don't know. Move on through. Had to admit him. These individuals are showing up and proving what myself, Jason Jones, Derek Moss, what we've been saying for years, is that a lot of them are committing crimes because they have been released from prisons in Venezuela. They're coming with criminal histories. They're beating up police officers. They're killing our Americans. They're raping our kids. They're doing all these horrific things. And it doesn't surprise us. I'm the first one to tell you, not everybody that comes to this country commits additional crimes. But we have a high percentage of them that do. Venezuela, by the way, has the lowest murder rate ever right now. What does that tell you?
Yeah, all the murderers are gone.
They're here.
Yeah. So is it true that they're emptying prisons? I mean,
This is not a hearsay. There was a memo by DHS last year admitting that, in fact, they knew that Venezuela's government was emptying their prison and rehabilitation centers or drug centers, releasing them on purpose because they knew with instructions to make, if you were going to get out, you're going to make your way to the U.S. That is not, we're not making that up. That's true. It was reported on, and DHS admitted that that was happening. And in fact, it has. El Tren de Aragua is heavily present in our country now.
Okay, so you're telling me that DHS has acknowledged that Venezuela, for example, is emptying their prisons and their rehabilitation centers with the understanding you get out if you leave here and go to the United States.
Yes.
And DHS has, in writing, said, we know that's happening. We know they're coming here. We're processing them in and have no idea where they are.
Correct.
How many people are we talking about?
Millions. And just Venezuela alone.
We're talking about, in the last 2 or 3 years, we've had estimated how many people have come across the border.
My estimation, the official number, I think, is about to hit 10 million.
Yeah, it's about 10, 11 million. Yeah, that's the official.
But my personal opinion, I think we're about 15 to 18 million.
Okay. And you're saying several million of those have come from Venezuela?
Yeah, oh yeah, of course. Oh yeah, a lot from Venezuela. I mean, the majority, a lot of them came from Venezuela. Now they're coming from every single part of the world, Africa, New Guinea, Mauritanian, is that the way you say that one? Middle East, China, India, Syria, Yemen, Russia, you name the country, they are coming. And this is the part that a lot of people don't understand, that don't report, because a lot of these individuals that are coming from these special interest countries that DHS labels them SIAs, like I said before, because they might be, and we don't know, but they come from countries that sponsor terrorism. So they would require additional screening. But we already caught over 500 of those on the terror watch list that we actually caught coming in through Arizona or Texas. Can you imagine how many we've actually missed that actually their whole purpose of coming into the United States is possibly to do us harm?
Next week on Fill in the Blanks, these pill mills down there that are pressing these pills, and the pills are 100% counterfeit, mm-hmm. that are being sold on the internet up here. And the DEA tells me 40 to 42% of them have lethal doses of fentanyl in them. Because I assume these are untrained people just mixing this stuff up in a bathtub. When it gets to putty consistency, they put it in a pill press.
And that's a good stat, because those are lethal doses. According to the DEA, 7 out of the 10 pills contain fentanyl.
Right.
So we're at a party. You take one, I take one. They both have fentanyl, but one dies and one the other one doesn't.
Yeah.
That pill looks exactly like a Xanax pill. It looks exactly like an Adderall. It looks exactly like an Oxycontin M30. It looks exactly like these drugs that are flowing on campuses, Dr. Phil.